Welcome to Going Beyond Medicine with Elaine Grohman. Conversations with people who are working to make a difference in our world. Now here's your host for Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio, Elaine Grohman.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Elaine Grohman on Empower Radio. And one of the big things that we want to talk about today, as always, Going Beyond Medicine, we're trying to bring people to the airways that are making a difference in the world. And today I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to speak with Hafsa Khanjwal, who is an assistant professor of South Asian history at Lafayette College. She completed her PhD at University of Michigan, which we are in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, and her research focuses on post-partisan state formation in India, India's occupied Kashmir. So welcome to the show, Hafsa.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, You were brought to my attention by a mutual friend, Leanne Cooper, and she brought to my attention an article that you had just written in the Washington Post on February 22nd. And the article was entitled, India Beats Its War Drums Over Pulwama. I'm not saying that correctly. Pulwama?
Mm-hmm.
And its occupation of Kashmir is being ignored. So thank you so much. Please help us understand a little bit of the history of what is happening in Kashmir. And as you having been there, what it is that we need to know.
Yeah, sure. So, Kashmir is situated between India and Pakistan. It was always part of the different rulers or empires that were in that region. But it was independent. It was sort of ruled by its own independent rulers for a significant amount of time. And when the British were in the Indian subcontinent, Kashmir was ruled by its own princely ruler. So the British didn't necessarily have direct control over it. And a majority of the population in Kashmir was Muslim. And when partition happened, so the partition is basically when the British leave the Indian subcontinent and kind of create these rifts between the different religious communities, the Muslims, Hindus, and the Sikhs. And there's then a plan to partition the Indian subcontinent into what is today's India and Pakistan. So Kashmir was this unique place that had a Muslim majority. So technically, it should have gone to Pakistan. But the ruler at the time was a Hindu Maharaja. And he initially wanted to remain independent. He wanted to create his own independent state. But there was an uprising within one of the regions of Kashmir against him. And he quashed that quite violently. And there were tribesmen from Pakistan that were coming in to liberate the people of Kashmir.
And when was that? When was that, please? When was that?
This was in 1947.
1947, okay.
Yeah. And this is, so the 1947 is when the British leave the Indian subcontinent. All of these events happen sort of right after.
Okay.
And the Maharaja basically asked the Indian government, which is just a newly formed government, for help against this army that's coming in from northwest Pakistan. And the Indian government tells him that he can have their help, military help, but he has to sign an instrument of accession, basically acceding to the Indian Union. And he does this. And what happens is that India has control over Kashmir's foreign affairs, defense, and communications, but everything else is autonomous. And there's also a condition in the Treaty of Accession that says that any future the future resolution of the region would be by reference to the people. So after all these hostilities calm down, then the people themselves will be able to decide where they want to go in the future. And really, the fact that that hasn't happened, the fact that the people haven't been able to decide their future, is what's at the root of the issue. So it goes back all the way to 1947. And the fact that Kashmiris were caught between these two new nation states, India and Pakistan, and were never able to assert themselves or figure out their future for themselves.
Well, what is astonishing is, from what I had read with your article, is that, or elsewhere, there's some research that I had done, is that Kashmir is considered the world's most militarized zone. Is that accurate still? So there's more military presence in that particular region than anywhere else in the world?
Yeah, it is the most densely militarized zone. And in 1947, when the Indian Army comes in to help the Maharaja, that's when Kashmiris basically consider their land to be occupied, is when that army comes in. But at that point, they're mostly in the border areas with Pakistan because they are fighting these wars with Pakistan. And they're not so much in the civilian areas. But what ends up happening is that in the late 1980s, between 1947 to the late 1980s, Kashmiris are trying peacefully to be able to have their right to determine their future. They're demanding a plebiscite. They're trying to go through more constitutional means to do so, but that gets repeatedly denied. And even though India initially was only supposed to have control over Kashmir's defense, foreign affairs, and communications, they slowly start to erode and get involved significantly in Kashmir's internal affairs as well. So in the late 1980s, you basically see significant frustration with what's happening in Kashmir, and people feel that, you know, peaceful means are not working. And around the world, there's also sort of a rise of uprisings against different powers. So, for example, in Afghanistan, there was the fight against the Soviets, and they won, right? So the Soviets had to leave. So Kashmiris felt that, okay, it feels that the only way we can get any kind of liberation is using violent means. So there's a militancy that begins, and it's helped by Pakistan. So many of these young, mostly young men who go across the border, get trained in Pakistan, and then come back and fight against the Indian state. And the Indian state responds to this quite brutally. So it sends in over 500,000, around 700,000 soldiers. And these are army, paramilitary, and police forces. And the whole region becomes intensely militarized. And as a result, there's a lot of people, civilians, who get killed in different massacres, especially if they're protesting. There's rapes that happen of Kashmiri women, enforced disappearances, so young men mostly taken from their homes. And, you know, to this day, their families don't know what's happened to them. There were a lot of mass graves that were found as well. So in the late 80s, early 90s, the situation becomes extremely traumatic for the people there. And it's interesting when we think about the high numbers of militarization. At any given point when the U.S. was in, say, Iraq or Afghanistan, for example, I don't think the numbers went beyond 150,000 soldiers, maybe at its height. But in Kashmir, there's 700,000 Indian soldiers. So you can just imagine the extent of the militarization. As soon as you step out of the airport in Kashmir, in the capital city of Srinagar, you'll just see soldiers, convoys everywhere. And it's very disquieting for people who are not used to being in that kind of atmosphere. So you can only imagine what it's like to live in that kind of atmosphere on a day-to-day basis.
Mm. My guest is Hafsa Khanswal, and she is the assistant professor of South Asian Studies at Lafayette College, but she completed her PhD at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor with a specialty in women's studies and the history of women's studies. And so can you tell me, please, is this, with all the research that you have done, is this appear to be religious-based, territorial-based? Why such a concentration of soldiers? Is there an inordinate amount of elements there that they're trying to get the mineral rights? What is it that is making mm-hmm. this so such a magnet for this violence?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, people look at the issue and they see that there's a Muslim majority population in Kashmir that's fighting against India, that's majority Hindu. So they immediately label it as a religious conflict. But, you know, when you actually go back to the history, the issue is a lot more complex, as it usually is. And it is really a political conflict. So as I was narrating some of the history, the root of the issue is that the Kashmiris themselves weren't able to decide their future. And over time, their whatever autonomy India gave them in 1947 was eroded. And India has also changed significantly as a country, and Pakistan has also changed significantly as a country since 1947. And what ends up happening is that both countries, you know, because the violence of the partition was so strong, you know, when India and Pakistan were partitioned, Hindus and Sikhs left what became Pakistan, came to India. Muslims left India, came to Pakistan. 10 million people became sort of refugees or were migrating at that time, and 1 million people were killed in that violence. So that was a really, really brutal time for the Indian subcontinent in general. And when these two nation states were created, they just became so antagonistic towards each other, and they felt such a strong threat from each other. So Kashmir kind of got caught up in all of this. And both of them tried to project their own fears and insecurities and anxieties over Kashmir. So for India, because Kashmir is the only Muslim majority state, it really wants to hold on to it to tell Pakistan that no, like, we didn't have to separate, right? Muslims could have lived in India peacefully. India is a secular nationalist country, so we didn't have to, you know, we didn't have to create this border. But what's ironic is that they're showing Pakistan exactly the opposite, that because of how they've treated Kashmiris as Muslims, they make them, you know, Kashmiris don't feel that they're part of India because of how they are treated so violently. And then on the other hand, Pakistan, you know, uses Kashmir to say that, you know, Muslims would have never been safe in a Hindu majority in India, which is why Kashmir should be with us. And again, kind of making the issue more into a religious one when it's really one of a political dispute. Mm. And when you have these two countries projecting their own narrative on the issue, the people aren't able to, you know, let the world know what exactly is going on. But when you actually listen to Kashmiris, they will always say that this was not never about religion. It was just about politics. And they're also aware that, you know, Kashmir is a very resource-rich place. So a lot of the water bodies that give water energy resources to India and Pakistan actually originate in Kashmir. And there's an Indus Water Treaty that the two countries have signed to divide that between them. But still, resources definitely play a role as well. It's a beautiful place. You know, for tourism and things like that. So there's a lot of desire for Kashmir on multiple levels. But I think ultimately it just boils down to what happened at partition. And, you know, Kashmir just became mixed up in it all.
Well, and as I was looking at a map, thank you for that explanation. As I was looking at a map, it shows that Kashmir is bordered by India, Pakistan, and China. Mm-hmm. Does China have any part of this conflict as well?
Yes, so there is a small part of Kashmir. So one-third belongs to Pakistan. That's called Azad Kashmir. And two-thirds is largely with India. But there's a small part called the Aksai Chin that's with China. So China definitely has an influence on what's happening, although it kind of does things more behind the scenes. But currently it's allied with Pakistan because the U.S. is more closer to India. So, you know, it's kind of touts Pakistan's line on the issue. And mm-hmm. China and India also sort of have a longer rivalry.
So tell me, please, how is it that you got involved in being aware of what is happening in Kashmir? And what does it have to do with your education and your PhD with history and women's studies?
Yeah, sure. So I was actually born in Kashmir. You know, I was born there. I lived there until I was six. And my family moved in 1993, which is when the height of the militancy, the violence, and the militarization was really at its height. My parents just did not want that kind of a situation for their kids. So we moved to the U.S. I grew up here, but I would spend quite a few summers in Kashmir growing up, just visiting my family, my grandparents. And I just became really interested in trying to understand the place, the people, the culture, the history, the politics. And of course, because it's beautiful, I kind of have more of an emotional attachment to it as well. And when I went to undergrad, I sort of had this idea that I would love to work for the U.S. Foreign Service and get to a point where I could, you know, resolve Kashmir from the American side, but I quickly realized that it wasn't so easy. So then I was interested in really changing the narrative that exists within at least the scholarly literature on Kashmir, which for the longest time completely has erased Kashmiri voices. And in some ways, it still continues to do so within the media. So most people, you know, when scholars, political scientists, historians wrote about Kashmir, it would just be that it was this place that was disputed between India and Pakistan, and everything would revolve around India and Pakistan. but you would never get a sense of what Kashmiris were interested in or what they wanted or how they felt about the situation. So that was really the lens that I wanted to interject in and really understand the history, especially after 1947, of how things went so downhill. Like, what did people really feel in Kashmir at the time? And how did, you know, what happened in the 50s and the 60s that eventually could have led to something like the militancy in the late 1980s. So I, during my graduate school time, I went to Kashmir. I spent a year there. I worked in the archives, the Srinagar State Archives, looked at a lot of government documents, bureaucratic documents. I also went to people's personal archives, found a lot of interesting literature, short stories that were written at that time. And it painted such a different picture of what was going on than what, you know, what you're used to hearing about. And one of the things that I thought was really significant is that people there were always kind of contesting Indian rule in their own ways, and never fully felt that they were a part of India. But the state, the Indian state, used different mechanisms to control that.
And so what did they use, if you would share that, please?
Yeah, sure. So they used things like economic development, for example. So Kashmir actually got significant economic aid from India throughout, you know, 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So there was a lot of infrastructure that was built because before partition happened, the region was quite poor. Most of the Muslim majority population were peasants. And in 1941, only 1% of the population was actually literate. So the local state, which kind of served as a vanguard for the Indian government, they built a lot of schools. There was a lot of development and interesting things that were happening to empower the people. But what was also happening is that many, as I found in my research, many of these developments also happened because the government wanted to change people's perceptions of India. They wanted them to feel that, okay, we're getting education, we're getting schools, we're getting bridges, all these buildings are being built, like, you know, this is good for us. When you have that kind of economic development and education, but you don't have political rights, then, you know, ultimately that whole project fails in a sense. And that's kind of what I looked at through my research, is that, yeah, if you had this great boon, many people got empowered, many people entered the middle class, but once they got there, they realized they couldn't actually, you know, vote in credible or legal elections or free elections, and they couldn't express themselves politically, which is what really caused a lot of that resentment later on. So that was centering around my research. But I also am really interested in doing more current research on the youth movement in Kashmir right now, just because I think that it gets overlooked a lot and it's very creative. So many youth since 2008, because of social media, because of different issues around the world, they are using different means to tell the story of Kashmir by either writing, poetry, making art, music. So I follow that as well in trying to understand what they want the world to know, that, you know, unfortunately, most people aren't listening.
Well, I'd like to talk to you about what it is they want the world to know. And as I'm looking at photos here, Kashmir is incredibly beautiful. And the thing that I'm noticing is, as you had mentioned, Hafsa, is that there's so much water and the beauty of the water and the purity of the water. And I think that unfortunately what happens when there are these military or under the guise of military interventions and all of these other political things is what they're really after is the resources. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what we have to be so aware of. So can you tell us what is the Kashmiri people want us to know? What do the youth in particular want us to know?
Yeah, I think they want the people to know that they want the world to know that they're living under really brutal military occupation, and that they've been denied their rights to sort of live a life of dignity. You know, just to give you a sense, when things get really bad in Kashmir, you know, when there's a killing and that killing, leads to a series of protests. And then at the protests, the Indian Army fires live ammunition or pellet guns. And and human rights groups have actually said that the Indian Army targets above the waist, which is a gross violation of international norms. So it actually isn't just trying to stop the protesters, but it is trying to effectively maim them and keep them from protesting in the future. you know, these are, this is like the everyday reality of living under that kind of a situation. So, you know, people don't have any means to express themselves peacefully, which is why, unfortunately, a number of the young men have turned to violence. And that violence is always seen by the international media and by India as this sort of radicalization or religious radicalization. And I think that's really unfortunate because for many of them also, you know, went through different injustices. The story of the attacker at the Pulwama incident that killed 40 Indian soldiers, he himself had a really traumatic experience with the army where he was just coming home from school one day and he was made to lick a circle around the army vehicle with his tongue.
Oh, my God. I was just going to ask you about this source of harassment.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you about this article, this specifically this young man, this 20-year-old Kashmiri man. And you know, we as you just said, thank you for what you just said, because we hear about the violence, but we don't hear about what is inciting the violence. What is causing these people to just be beyond their last straw? And please continue with what was happening with this young man.
Yeah, absolutely. So he, so he was forced to do that. And that, you know, that creates a lot of indignity for a young person, a young man growing up, having to see this army presence in his house, wondering why it's there, what it's doing, the threat that it poses for his family. And he had members of his family that were killed in protests as well. So you can just see that, you know, it's not this sort of immediate, like, religious radicalization that happens that one day he just decides he wants to blow himself up. But there is this kind of, you know, over time, this level of frustration and feeling humiliated that, you know, you feel that this is the only way you can get back at your people who are occupying you. So I think that, you know, that one of the things that the people in Kashmir are trying to say is that we don't want violence. Like, when you bear the brunt of violence, the last thing you want is to escalate that. But, you know, you're not giving us any options. You're not letting us protest peacefully. You're not giving us our political rights. So what else, like, what else do you do? Like, what else can we do to let the world know that things are not normal here? Things are not happy here. And India does this interesting thing where every couple of years, when maybe there's nothing going on for 6 months, 7 months, you know, people also get tired of protesting all the time. They want to be able to go on with their daily lives. India tells everyone, like, look, everything is fine. It's just Pakistan that's creating all these troubles. And that's another narrative that's really problematic, is that everything is seen as, you know, it's Pakistan instigating. And even though in the late 1980s, Pakistan did play a role in supporting the militancy, today it's completely indigenous, not just the militancy, but also the just like the mass civilian uprising. It's not, you know, India says that Pakistan pays people money, like 500 rupees, which is the equivalent of, it's not much to protest. But if you imagine that the protests are so violent that the army fires on them, you can only ask the question, why would people just take 500 rupees to put themselves in the line of death? So it's clearly not that they're being paid to protest, but they're actually feeling this grievance. And finally, they want people to also know that this isn't a religious issue, and that, you know, even though the media paints them as communal, Kashmir used to have a Kashmiri Hindu population. They were called the Pandits. It was a small minority, around 3-5% of the population. And in the late 80s and the early 90s, many of them were forced to leave. And there's a lot of narratives about why and how that happened. And I can go into that if you'd be interested. But
yes,
people now,
yes,
want... Yeah, sure. So, you know, the Kashmiri Pandits were... very well educated. They were a minority that before India came, during colonial rule, they were highly educated. They served in the government businesses and administration. And after partition, they sort of remained in power. And many of them were aligned with the Indian state, Kashmiris that were aligned with the Indian state. And in the late 1980s, when the militancy erupted, one of their primary targets was people who were collaborating with the Indian state. And it was both Muslims and Hindus, not just Hindus. So there were a number of people that were killed or assassinated in that violence. And there was an atmosphere of fear that was created for the minority community. But what ends up happening is that the state takes advantage of that fear, and as many Kashmiri Muslims themselves believe, is that they actually engineered the exit of the Kashmiri Pandits so that the state could do whatever it wanted with the Muslims. And the governor at the time was a particularly brutal person named Jagmohan. So since that time, unfortunately, the relationships that the Kashmiri Muslims and the Hindus had have been completely destroyed. I mean, they used to live together for decades, you know, were friends, worked together, lived together as neighbors. But within sort of a period of a couple of days, a vast majority of them left Kashmir, lived in different camps in Jammu and another region of the state, as well as in India, different parts of India. And there they kind of were absorbed by more of the Hindu nationalist right-wing rhetoric that was happening in India. And they took a really strong line against the Kashmiri Muslims. So that whole incident is also just a really unfortunate time. And there's so much negativity again between these two communities. But again, it's not because of religion. Like, if you can have people living together so peacefully for so long, but all of a sudden something like this erupts, it's really how these political moments create these fractures amongst communities that then leads to religious tension, right? It's not that tension is always there. So I think that's also really important to know when trying to understand the situation.
Yes. Well, we do need to take a quick break. When we come back, we were going to continue our discussion with my guest, Hafsa Khanjwal, who is an assistant professor of Southeast Asian history in Lafayette at the Lafayette College in Pennsylvania. And please stay with us. I'd like to talk with you when we return about how this is affecting the women and children in particular in Kashmir. I'm Elaine Grohman. This is Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Empower Radio, an entire radio station devoted to your personal development, expanding your conscious awareness, and empowering positive change. Meet our hosts and listen online at EmpowerRadio.com, on iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher Radio, or iTunes, or download the Empower Radio app for your smartphone or tablet. It's free in the App Store, and it lets you listen to our shows and podcasts on demand. Empowering people, empowering change. Empower Radio, online at EmpowerRadio.com.
I don't believe it. My savings are gone. They're gone.
You're kidding.
Nope, they're gone. They're gone, gone.
Okay, all right. Think about it. Where did you have them last?
I remember I was home, then I took them, and then I spent them on that vacation to Aruba. Then I bought this miniature suit of armor I saw in the in-flight magazine.
And that's the last you saw of your savings?
Yes.
This is so weird.
I know, right?
Weird? Not really. Not saving now means no money later. You'd be surprised how quickly a little money from every paycheck can really add up. Put away a few bucks, feel like $1 million. For free ideas and easy ways to save, go to feedthepig.org. That's feedthepig.org.
The armor is cool, though. Oops. I think I broke its gauntlet.
You broke my favorite part!
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
When Dad needed help getting around, I became his driver. Any daughter would do the same. But soon enough, he needed help doing more things. And it was up to me to be his personal shopper and financial manager, too. And before I knew it, Dad moved in with me. So I became his cook, his personal assistant, his physical therapist, and even his nurse. When I started taking care of Dad, I didn't realize all the roles I'd have to play. But no matter what, I know I'm still his daughter.
We understand the many roles you play. And to help, we created an online caregiving resource center. At aarp.org/caregiving, you can find resources and connect with the caregiving community. Together, we can better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving to learn more. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Radio to inspire, encourage, and empower you. This is Empower Radio.
Now back to Elaine Groman and Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio.
EmpowerRadio.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to the show. My guest today is Hafsa Khanjwal, who is an assistant professor in South Asian history at Lafayette College, and she has her PhD from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor with a special interest in women's studies and history. So welcome back to the show, Hafsa.
Thanks.
Can you please, let's continue with all of this important things that, you know, so many people, and I'm embarrassed to say that I knew very little about Kashmir. And I think that that is part of the problem, is that the information has really not been shared in, disseminated widely, and certainly not the exact cause of all of the problems are not as known as you're elucidating here today.
Yeah, and I think there's a reason for that. One is that within, at least in the U.S., Kashmir isn't necessarily a significant point of focus. It was at different points in the past, but especially because the U.S. is so involved in many other places, it's not a priority. And India also has a way of, again, making what's happening in Kashmir, painting it through this rhetoric of the war on terrorism, that, you know, India is dealing with this internal problem of terrorism in Kashmir, so everyone else kind of just needs to keep at bay. And they use that excuse to basically have a free hand to do whatever they want in Kashmir. And it's hard to imagine a country like India, which is so, you know, it's supposed to be the world's largest democracy. It's a home of so many cultures, vibrancy, Bollywood, right? These are the images, yoga, that Americans associate with India. It's not necessarily that this is, you know, in one particular place, it's such an occupying force and such a violent force. So it's hard to kind of test that narrative of India, whereas in Pakistan, people just kind of already assume that Pakistan is a failed state. And that, of course, it would be then contributing to the violence in Kashmir. But what's interesting is that when this recent Pulwama incident happened, India was the one that was really just, and, you know, the Indian government and also the media, the general public, were just braying for war. But it was the Pakistani public and then the Pakistani leadership under Imran, the current prime minister, Imran Khan, that was actually saying, no, like, these two countries can't afford to go to war. We have nuclear weapons. This is not in the world's best interest. Like, let's come to the table and dialogue. So it is really interesting how these narratives get completely twisted from the reality of what's going on in the U.S.
So are people coming together to see if there's a nonviolent way to begin to start this conversation, to speak openly and honestly about what is happening?
You know, it's really hard. In Kashmir, people have tried, but they just are not given that political space. There's only there's a leadership there that's called the Joint Resistance Leadership. It's made up of a conglomeration of pro-freedom parties. But most of them, you know, when things happen, they're always arrested. They're, for most of their lives, they live under house arrest as it is. They're not, you know, they're not able to address large congregations or speak to people or mobilize people. They're always under house arrest. And then recently, one of them was taken to actual jail because India's, you know, just kind of making things a lot worse in Kashmir in time for the election. Prime Minister Modi is up for re-elections in a couple of months, and the BJP had not been doing well in the past couple of years. They've made a number of economic blunders. So, you know, from my perspective as an analyst, I think that a lot of what's happening there right now is directly related to the current government wanting to sort of shore up nationalist support and sentiment in favor of war and more violence so that they can re-elect Modi. And that's really troubling, that people's lives are just, you know, getting completely destroyed because of politics in this sense. At this point, even though Pakistan has offered to have talks, India hasn't accepted them, and the international community hasn't really done much to push to push India to come to the table. There are the United Nations last year in June came out with a really important report, the first ever human rights report on Jammu and Kashmir, and they detailed exactly what's happening on both sides of the line of control, on the Indian side as well as the Pakistan side, but especially speaking to some of the significant and flagrant human rights violations that India is committing. And they, again, the UN, you know, this large international body, again, talked about self-determination, that Kashmiri should be able to take part in their future. But the Indian government and the media completely rejected the report, an international report, and said that it was motivated and fallacious. So you can only imagine, you know, India's not serious at all about addressing the issue, and they're able to get away with it because so many countries have strong economic and business ties with India. So they don't necessarily want to, you know, rock that boat.
Well, thank you for what you're doing. So my guest today is Hafsa Khanjwal, and she is written extensively for both the article that I had seen was in the Washington Post. She's written for Al Jazeera English, the Kindle magazine, Foreign Policy magazine, Kashmir Life, Kashmir Inc., Al Jazeera Center for Study, and has spoken on Kashmir for Al Jazeera English on the Stream and Inside Story news program. So you're making headway to at least getting information out there. What kind of response are you getting as a Kashmiri woman, as someone whose family is originally from there, who's seen firsthand what this challenge has done to so many individuals? How are you?
Yeah.
What kind of feedback are you getting from what you have written about and spoken about?
Yeah, I mean, first I want to say that it's actually really hard to get this narrative out there. Even for, you know, when Kashmiris tried to write for the international media, for example, the New York Times, Washington Post, it's really hard because people still don't see the issue as one that involves Kashmiris, really. So they're, you know, whenever something big happens, all you see is a hot take by an Indian and a hot take by a Pakistani. And they are, you know, covering their own country's bases when it comes to the issue. So the Kashmiri voice is rarely heard. We finally have, like, Kashmiris who are now outside of Kashmir studying. They've gotten their PhDs who can kind of speak to that narrative. And I hope that things will change. So, you know, in Kashmir, when you know, I write or I speak, people are just so happy that there's someone out there telling their story. I forgot to mention earlier that it's very difficult for journalists, human rights activists, to actually get access to Kashmir. So India does not give international journalists visas to come to come to India, particularly if they're interested in reporting on Kashmir. So you can only imagine the kinds of stories that get completely overlooked in the international medium when you only have people reporting from their base in New Delhi in India or in New York or in DC without actually going to Kashmir and seeing for themselves firsthand what's going on. And if a journalist manages to go kind of under the radar, they're always watched, they're followed, they're intimidated, and they're not able, you know, they're not able to do their work. So it is really important then for voices to come out to actually say what's happening. I get significant pushback and but enough hate mail from kind of Indian nationalists or right-wing Hindu nationalists who have a few choice words about what I'm saying. And if you kind of go through the comments of, you know, even that Washington Post piece, you can get a sense of how these narratives of, you know, Kashmir is integral to India, like this is ours, like you'll never have it, or these are all Islamic radicals or terrorists, like we're here to fight terrorism. Those kinds of narratives are the ones that keep on getting pushed. And that's, you know, that's ultimately the response that I get. So it's not easy work, but it's so much harder for people in Kashmir to write about this because they, you know, the backlash against them is far more significant.
Mm. So please let's talk about what are the human rights issues that obviously will always come with any challenge of war, and especially as it relates to the innocent civilians, the women, the children, the elderly, that are caught in the midst of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, anything that you can imagine in terms of what happens in such conditions happens in Kashmir. I can just start with, you know, just some stories. In terms of children, there are children that get caught either in cross-firing or you know, they're just walking home from the street. So the 2010 agitation was starting because a tear gas canister hit the head of a young boy. He was just a teenager, and people really rebelled and protested against that. So usually what ends up happening is that there's one instance that kind of sparks a series of protests. It could be the rape of two women, for example, in 2009, when, you know, two women were found drowned in a stream, and it was clear that they had been raped. And the Indian government completely denied that had happened. And they put, you know, they made their own investigative agency that looked at the bodies of the women and concluded that nothing had happened, that these two women had just drowned. So not only are there human rights violations, but there's also a denial of them that happens then at the end. And there's, you know, lots of extrajudicial killings. So people are just killed, taken from their homes, disappeared. Never, as I was talking about earlier, they, for 30 years, 15 years, their families haven't seen or heard from them. Lots of people, young people get arrested for writing things on Facebook or for protesting. So they're put in jail for months at a time without any legal due process under an act that's called the Public Safety Act. There's also another act in Kashmir that's called the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which basically gives the armed forces complete right to do whatever they want to do without being prosecuted. So when we speak about things like rapes or enforced disappearances or these extrajudicial killings or things, you know, when protests, large protests happen and the army fires into crowds, targets them above their waist, blinds many of them through these things called the pellet guns. There's, in the last series of protests, 1,500 young people were blinded through these protests. And, you know, all of that, not one Indian soldier has been brought to court or has been given a fair, you know, like a trial to address some of these human rights violations. So there are Kashmiri human rights groups like the Jammu Kashmir Civil Society, and they document all of these human rights abuses. They have lists. They're, you know, people are trying to make sure that this is, you know, if the state doesn't address this or deal with this, at least that the civil society and the people will keep all of this if it's ever needed in the future. And, you know, outside of these kind of more flagrant human rights violations, it's just that day-to-day life in Kashmir is not normal. And one of the only ways that people have been able to protest is by practicing this thing called a hartal, which is a strike. And the joint resistance leadership, anytime there's a killing or something happens, they call for a hartal or a strike, which basically means that the schools are shut down, the businesses are shut down. People are expected to just stay in their home and kind of stop all activity that day to protest, you know, that this killing has happened. And even though it's, of course, a peaceful means of protest, it also means that this could go on for months and months at a time, which it does. In 2010 and 2016, this cycle of violence was going on for 3, 4, 5 months. And that meant that students didn't go to school for that long time. So you can only imagine, I mean, you have all of this, all of these young people that aren't going to school, that are frustrated, they're stuck at home inside, they're not even able to go outside and play with their friends because the situation outside can be so volatile. So there's sort of a second level of life that is interrupted and so difficult for people. You know, if you're poor, for example, and the economy essentially shuts down, how are you, especially if you're a day-to-day laborer, how are you supposed to make ends meet in those 3 months? So people, you know, economically suffer, they suffer educationally. And then there's a lot of PTSD and depression and trauma as well. The statistics for that are pretty staggering. I think almost 3/4 of the population suffers from some sort of PTSD. And it's, you know, it's not an easy place to be, and people are so anxious. And moments of crises and occupation like this, there's also a lot of distrust where you know, you don't know who the other person is. You don't know who they necessarily work for. They could be an Indian agent. They could be a Pakistani agent. So the social fabric, the ties that kind of build communities are also destroyed as a result. And, you know, people become so alienated and depressed. And that, you know, that I think is also, you know, a gross human right, that people aren't able to live the way that they would and just experience life in the way that they should, that their entire life is completely mediated by this conflict.
Mm. And the unbelievable amount of emotional trauma and the generational trauma that these children in particular are growing up with. How can they not be broken? I mean, it's just staggering to me.
Yeah. No, they are, but they're also quite resilient. I mean, you know, I speak about victimization because that certainly exists, but I really think that the people have been quite resilient because they've had to. I mean, you'll be shocked to find, you know, the stretches of human resilience in moments like this. So just to give you a small example, when this attack happened, and in India, Kashmiris that were living in India were beaten up, they were harassed, right, because they were seen as the fifth columnist, that they would have somehow been necessarily attached to or sympathetic to the attack. And there's a number of tourists, Indian tourists, that were in Kashmir itself at the time. And, you know, these are Indian tourists that Kashmiris know don't particularly think very highly of them and probably, you know, agree with the government of India on what their stance on Kashmir is. But the airport was closed and all of these tourists were then stranded. And the hotels actually offered accommodation for free for that time that the hotels were that the airport was closed. And people were welcoming tourists into their homes to just get free food and, you know, not have to stress about being stranded in Kashmir in such a volatile time. And imagine that, as, you know, if you're a Kashmiri and you're opening your heart and home to an Indian who probably just sees you through the lens of how the Indian media portrays Kashmiris as terrorists or extremists, you have to have a huge heart to be able to do that, to be able to be so welcoming after living under such an occupation of the very people, you know, who kind of support and enable this occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me, like, the stories of resilience in Kashmir are the most inspiring. The fact that people still continue to have a lot of faith. You know, every time I go, I try to visit some of the shrines and the mosques in the area, and they're very beautiful historically. But you also just see women, especially there, just trying to find some moment of peace because, you know, the life around them is so chaotic. And, you know, they're very dignified. They're very faithful. They always say that, you know, this is a time that's going to come to pass and we'll get through this. You know, God never promised us that our life would be easy. And it's really humbling to hear those kinds of things. And I just can't imagine how people can feel that given the kinds of lives that they've had to live with.
Mm. It's just remarkable that, as you're saying, the resilience of humanity. Yeah. And the unfortunate cloaking of information to the outside world, and to always, it seems like there's always this rhetoric about the violence that happens without understanding why is the violence happening. You know, you can only imagine if someone were continuously harming your loved ones, you would not want to stand idly by and let it continue, you know?
Right, yeah.
So where do you go from here? Where do you go from here as the work that you're doing, and where do you see your work continuing as not only a journalist, but as a professor of history, really?
Yeah, I mean, I'm working alongside a number of other Kashmiris and non-Kashmiris who are really interested in the situation. So they're academics. They're also members of the diaspora, people from the South Asian progressive, kind of more progressive communities who are able to see behind or beyond the nationalist rhetoric of India and Pakistan. So I think we're just really trying to just raise the issue in different forums, especially educate Americans about the issue. And, you know, I continue with my work. I'm working on my book based off my dissertation research. But I try to speak and, you know, get the message out there as much as possible. But you can imagine it's not an easy space to be in, especially when there is a lot of hostility towards what I'm saying. I hope that more people will become aware and educate themselves and also take it up, you know, in different ways that they can, to at least try to raise awareness in the U.S. About what's happening.
Well, especially in the United States, where there are so many Indian and Pakistani citizens, you would wonder, or from, you know, that heritage, are they aware of what is happening? Are they involved in any way to try to remediate any of these things back home?
I think the extent from what I understand is, you know, they're just trying, the ones who are more progressive minded are just trying to encourage the U.S. to make sure that the two countries don't go to war because of what that would mean for the region, given that both have nuclear weapons. So, you know, they're interested in kind of at least maybe keeping the status quo. So there was there were protests that were held in different cities around, you know, around the time of the escalation of Indian and Pakistani descent, or, you know, citizens that are living in the U.S., Pakistani Indian Americans. But again, it was really interesting to see how they were talking about, you know, no to war, like saying no to war, we don't want to go to war. And they, you know, at many points forgot that there is actually a war that's happening there currently, and that's in Kashmir. So I think, you know, I think a lot of Indians and Pakistanis also need to be educated and be able to see the situation from the perspective of the people who have borne the brunt of the conflict.
Yes.
And that's kind of a, you know, more of a long-term thing that needs to happen. And hopefully the three communities can at some point put more pressure on the U.S. to, you know, be a bit more vocal about what's happening in Kashmir. I mean, if the U.S. claims to be a supporter of democracy and human rights, then that's really important to not just do that in areas where the U.S. has particular, you know, interests in getting involved, and ignore the other places that, you know, it's not necessarily as interested in.
Well, you know, and I think that what you're just saying is so important, because we all as human beings need to begin to look at what is true, not necessarily just as what is written about in propaganda or things that are fanned because of violence. Why is the violence? What is the initial cause of all of these things? And I keep going back to this beautiful photo I'm seeing of the water. Most people are going to war really over resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is it that they're really fighting about? And then the real reason is cloaked by all of these other things. How do we begin to get to that place of honesty so that we can begin to have some kind of global truths and then global peace? That's the big challenge. So in the work that you're doing, is there any way that people can get in touch with you if they're interested in having you come and speak or to write or to collaborate with them in any way?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would be happy to get in touch with anyone who would want to talk to me about any of this, and also connect people with others who are also working. You know, if you're in a different city, we do have people who can speak on this issue kind of throughout America. So we are also working to launch a Kashmiri diaspora-led initiative called Stand With Kashmir that should have different ways for people to get involved. But, you know, I think one, the first step for any listener is to just get educated on the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I could recommend a recent volume that was written by a few of my colleagues called Resisting Occupation in Kashmir. And it does, it was published by University of Pennsylvania Press. It does a really good job of kind of giving people a sense of the history and why the situation exists, but also really using some fascinating ethnographic detail of what the context of Kashmir and the occupied context, what that entails for the lives of the people who are living there and how they sort of live within those conditions.
Could you say the name of that book again, please, and where it might be available?
Yes, it's called Resisting Occupation in Kashmir.
Okay.
It's an edited volume, and it should be available on Amazon, and it's through University of Pennsylvania Press. More okay. of an academic book, yeah.
Okay, great. So is there anything else that you would like to share for ways for people to get in touch with you personally?
Sure. I can give my email address.
Okay. Whatever you feel comfortable with, please don't feel like you need to.
It's easily available on my Lafayette page. So if you Google my name, Hafsa Khanjwal, you should be able to get to my email.
Okay.
At Lafayette College. Yes.
Okay. And that is, where exactly is Lafayette College?
It's in Easton in Pennsylvania in the Lehigh Valley.
Okay. Great.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for all that you're doing and for bringing this information to the world. And especially as the voice of a young woman whose family is from there, and that you've had the opportunity to go back and forth and to really look and help to educate us. And again, I have to admit that I was completely ignorant to all of this. So I thank you for this opportunity to have this conversation with you. And I'm glad that you're an alumni of the University of Michigan, that you were able to, you know, as you may know, that Empower Radio is stationed in Michigan. So please feel free to be in touch, to stay in touch. So my guest has been Hafsa Khanjwal, the Assistant Professor of Asian Studies, South Asian Studies at Lafayette College, and really bringing the importance information about what is happening in Kashmir and how we need to begin to bring peace and truth so that maybe there'll be possibility for peace in our world. Thank you so much for all that you do. This is Elaine Grohman on Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio. You too can do your best to look at things in a new way. Be willing to examine those things that you have been taught are true and find out if they actually are. Thank you very much.